There won't be any visuals to accompany the recording. So that's the warning that comes. My name is Richard Cleaves. I've been Minister of Congregational Federation Churches for more than 41 years. I'm now retired and living in Penabon Tarocor, known to many as Bridge End in South Wales. I'm Secretary of the Congregational History Society. And it was as the URC and the Federation were celebrating their 50th anniversaries last year that we started making plans to have a joint meeting of the URC History Society and the Congregational History Society. An opportunity to meet with each other, albeit online, learn a little about each other's societies, and explore two of the libraries that have underpinned much of the research our two societies are interested in. And who knows where today's meeting will take us into the future. As Secretary of the Congregational History Society, I've been sharing with Michael Hopkins in planning today's meeting. Michael explains he's unable to be with us as he is at the Winchester URC Spring School today. So let me explain the plan for the morning, and then we'll make a proper start. First of all, we're going to begin with a couple of introductions to the URC History Society and our Congregational History Society. And then Alan is going to share his paper, Dr. Williams Trust and Library, 1716 to 2023, an overview. And after questions, we'll have a short break at around 11 o'clock, comfort break of 5 minutes or so. And then the second part of our main part of our morning, we hand over to Helen Weller, who will be introducing us to Westminster College Library, its history and riches. And we will then have questions after her talk and finish at midday. So that's the plan for the morning. So we're going to begin with an introduction to the URC History Society. I'm going to hand over to now this has to be worded very carefully, a very old friend, in the sense that we were both in the 1970 Society in Mansfield back in the day. I think I was certainly there, 71. So it was in that the heady days of anticipation and then beginnings with URC, Congregational Federation, EFCC, and so on. So it's a delight to be sharing with David today, and I'm going to hand over to David to introduce us to the URC History Society. David.
Richard, thanks so much.
I should also say, of course, this almost goes without saying, please would everybody but the speaker mute themselves, and that will aid the flow of the morning, of course. So, David, over to you.
Well, thank you, Richard, and thanks for the memories of Mansfield. I was around from 73 to 76 as an undergraduate and a member of the society, and that friendship's great and has, you know, lasted through our working lives, and so it's lovely to be sharing with you today. URC History Society, unsurprisingly, came into being in 1972, seeking to provide continuity with the work of the Presbyterian Historical Society and the Congregational Historical Society for those Congregationalists who'd opted to become part of the new denomination. And its aims are to encourage interest in and promote the study of the history of the URC and its antecedent traditions and their missions and work. So that's three nations, four traditions, five centuries, and Apache yet worldwide inevitable legacy of empire. The canvas, I think, is broad for researchers. Our work as a society is focused around the journal, which comes out twice a year, and such other publications as seem necessary to the society's council, and the promotion of an annual lecture. To be given this year by Professor Stuart J. Brown of Edinburgh University, or formerly of Edinburgh University, on June the 17th at Crown Church, Church of Scotland in London, and all are welcome. Every other year we hold a residential conference which unites the annual lecture with papers by members. And we also have a responsibility within the URC itself to encourage and advise on the preservation of historical records. And we can offer small grants to stimulate and enable historical studies associated with those traditions. As we look to the future, we're continuing to explore the possibilities of virtual working. This webinar and the series earlier this year on the 50th anniversary are examples of the ways in which we're trying to get into that and find ways of making younger researchers aware of the richness of the materials of which we are custodians. And that's an agenda, I suspect, which is echoed in other denominational historical societies across the land. When I completed my doctorate, which is more than 40 years ago now, one of my ministerial colleagues groaned, "Oh no, not another branch of the nostalgia industry." I like to think that as a society, we don't do nostalgia. Rather, we seek to show what a diverse, complicated and extraordinary thing the past is, and how unexpectedly and illuminatingly and sometimes surprisingly, it can help explain the present, and indeed maybe offer resources for Christian living now. So that's just a very brief overview, Richard, of what we do.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, David. Congregational History Society was formed in 1978 as the Congregational History Circle. And then following discussion with the ORC History Society, the History Circle was renamed the Congregational History Society in 2007. It welcomes members from all backgrounds with an interest in congregational history and the history of religious dissent, and is independent of all denominations. It's had occasional meetings, occasional talks, occasional events around Federation's Assembly, for example. It's had an annual chapel crawl at one time, visiting historic churches. But its main work has always been through its twice-yearly journal. And that offers a forum for the discussion of all aspects of congregational history. The magazine contains news and views, correspondence, three or four significant articles and book reviews. And readers have commented that they enjoy the lively style of the magazine. The forthcoming issue, Peter, who is with us today, will no doubt be pleased to take any subscriptions to issues for £5 a year, including postage. It's not a bad deal. Will include some reflections that I've been doing on Richard Price's 200th anniversary, one of our local folk here in Bridgend, with a remarkable insight into an alternative understanding of monarchy for those who are a little sceptical of the theology underpinning the traditional coronation services of the established Church of England, of the one who is head of the United Kingdom. And it's just a fascinating thing. So just one kind of taste of what's to come in our forthcoming issue. One of the things that we've done as well is to put all the past copies online, and there's a fully indexed archive of past copies at biblicalstudies.org.uk or via our website. And it's good to see the range of articles and how accessible they are, going back to all but the first two issues, so going all the way back to about 1980. A little glimpse of our Congregational History Society. Now I'm going to introduce our first speaker, Alan Argent. Alan is Senior Research Fellow at Dr. Williams's Library in London, and since leaving Westminster College, Cambridge in 1977, he has been Minister of Trinity Congregational Church, Brixton, where he grew up. He's also ministered at St. Helier Morden for 30 years and Dundonald Wimbledon 20 years, and was part of the team that set up the Congregational Federation's integrated training course teaching congregational history and principles for many years. He has edited the Congregational History Society magazine, initially History Circle magazine, since 1991. And in all that period has built up what is a highly respected journal and has contributed immensely to the field. He has a PhD in London history, 1640 to 49, having recently discovered the electronic version of our very first Congregational History Circle magazine editor, Bill Ashley Smith, a wonderful thesis on the contribution of the academies of the 18th century to the modern university curriculum, has now been made available as a Durham University e-thesis. So I look forward to the time when Alan's PhD in London history 1640 to 49, which must surely still be interesting, becoming an electronic thesis and available to us all. Alan has had extensive publications, particularly in recent years, beginning with Korean Encounters in 2007, when he reflected on a sabbatical in South Korea, and the book reflects many years of active support Alan has given to Korean churches in London. Then there's The Nature of the Household of Faith and Principles of Congregationalism, a primer for the Congregational Federation, a distillation of much that he's taught generations of our ministers and others in our churches. A biography of Elsie Chamberlain, The Independent Life of a Woman Minister. Elsie Chamberlain, of course, being the first woman chaplain to the forces and a pioneer of religious broadcasting with the BBC. The Transformation of Congregationalism, 1900 to 2000, which gives wonderful insights into the development of the Congregational Union, then Congregational Church, then URC, Federation, EFCC, and so on through the 20th century. The Angel's Voice, a magazine for young men in Brixton, was an archive, really, of magazines published by young people in his church in Brixton between 1910 and 1913. And he's edited that book for the London Record Society, and it's a wonderful social history of those immediately pre-First World War years. Then there was a lecture published in 2017 on Dr. William's Library, A Good Library Under the Direction of the Dissenters, and that was followed by the Richard Baxter Treatises, A Catalogue and Guide, and finally, last year, Dr. Williams's Trust and Library, A History. And Alan's talk this morning is linked with this most recent publication. And were we meeting in person, I'm sure he'd have a pile of the books for us to purchase. Instead, immediately after the session, you can acquire them on whatever online bookstore you want to use. Or indeed, borrow them from Westminster Library, as Helen is suggesting. He's written numerous articles and reviews in the Journal of the URC History Society and the Congregational History Society magazine, several entries in the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, and Who They Were, edited by Clyde Binfield and Jay Taylor, and Notes for Robert Pope's The T&T Clark Companion to Nonconformity. Alan also has an encyclopedic knowledge of the fortunes and misfortunes of his beloved Crystal Palace Football Club, and once he does retire, we're looking forward to the publication of that volume as well. Though those of us who support Leicester City look forward to it with trepidation. So without more ado, it's over to Alan for your paper, please.
I don't know where his stuff about Crystal Palace came from. I remember going to see Jimmy Greaves play for Chelsea when I was a boy, I think, when he'd just come back from Italy. But enough of that. First slide, please, Robert. Okay, there we are, and we'll have the second as well then. So this is the building which many of you may be familiar with. Dr. Williams's library has been occupying that building, was built in the late 1840s, and Dr. Williams has been there since 1890. So it's quite a time, but it's the fourth home of Dr. Williams's library. It's necessarily where it must be forever. I've been using the library there since about 1972, 73, when I was a postgraduate student. And as, again, many of you may know, it's kind of always had the feeling of a member's private club, perhaps a gentleman's private club, though there have been plenty of women in there, of course. It has an old world charm, but of course then the question comes, when do you let the fresh air in? When do you open the windows, as it were? So then we move on to our next slide. And here is Daniel Williams himself, and we don't actually know when he was born. He is listed by Calamy as among the ejected ministers, but that's quite inaccurate. He isn't an ejected minister because he didn't have a living in 1662 to be ejected from. I might add, by the way, those of you who know, David Wykes, who was the principal of Dr. Williams' library, David, director rather, of Dr. Williams' library, David suggested to me that we should put Daniel Williams' portrait on the front of the book. I rather thought the old chap like Daniel Williams there would probably put everybody off, so we're probably better off with the library, but I couldn't avoid putting Daniel Williams into the book as the first illustration. He's a Presbyterian minister. He's not a Unitarian, if that's of interest to you. He's very fearful, as he would be in the early 18th century, he's very fearful of Roman Catholicism, and in particular of a Catholic, possible Catholic successor to Queen Anne, and Queen Anne, of course, herself, was not particularly friendly to nonconformists. Williams spent 23 years in Ireland, and he incurred death threats in Dublin, and after 23 years he had to leave because of his outspoken anti-Catholic views. Of course, the fear about, the widespread fear among Protestants about a Catholic successor is, in some sense, is justified, but after 1746 in the Battle of Culloden, it becomes no longer a threat. So there are issues, perhaps, then, that the trust and the trustees have to think through. Daniel Williams here, he married twice, and perhaps those marriages are the source of his income. He has considerable finance, which he leaves at his death. He has a 40-page will in print, and the library occurs perhaps on page 37 or 38, very much towards the end of his will. So perhaps you might argue it's not primary in his thinking. Nevertheless, in time, the library does become the main aspect of the Trust's work, certainly by the 1890s, when it's moved into Gordon Square, 14 Gordon Square, which was previously called University Hall. He marries twice. Both of the ladies he marries are widows. The second one is a Huguenot of the Huguenot family. And then we might ask the question, is it important that Daniel Williams is Welsh? It may be important that he's not English. 23 years in Ireland are important. And of course, whilst we're at this United Kingdom theme, he gains his honorary doctorate, two honorary doctorates from Scottish universities, from Glasgow and Edinburgh, for his support for the Act of Union in 1707. So he's an Anglo-Welsh Presbyterian, kind of not quite a figure for our time, but an interesting figure nevertheless. America is also important to Daniel Williams, but of course before 1776, or arguably before 1783, and the peace settlement after the American Revolution, before 1776, he's talking about British colonies in North America. He's not talking about the United States by any means. America is important to Daniel Williams, as his will shows. He finances missionaries on the American frontier. He has gifts for Harvard as well, Harvard College, as he always calls it. The next slide, please, Robert. Here we have a list of the trustees, not necessarily the first trustees, and their addresses, as appears in one of the trustees' general minute books. And you can see by their addresses, the vast majority of them are in London, by which I mean the city of London, the 1 square mile. I don't mean Westminster. You've got one there, is it in Westminster? Edmund Calamy, Old Palace Yard, Westminster, but that's not the city of London, that's outside. You've got one in Brentwood, Hoxton. Benjamin Shepherd is living at Hoxton. Hoxton is where Daniel Williams himself chooses to live, which is outside the city proper, but still to the east. And of course, there's Jabez Earl in Covent Garden, Convent Garden, as it is here. Again, Covent Garden is a new development in the late 17th century. Inigo Jones designs St. Paul's Covent Garden in the late 1630s. Covent Garden is being filled out in the late 17th century as the City of London moves to the east, and a City of London moves to the west, and Westminster moves to the east. And so there are new developments there. So Covent Garden isn't quite the City of London, but most of these trustees, by far the majority of them, there were 23 trustees set up by Daniel Williams, the majority of them again being Presbyterian ministers, most of them are based in the City of London. So they're all within walking distance of each other. And that's kind of important. And we move on to the next slide, please, Robert. This is the second book, as you can see, number 2 there. My book on Dr. Williams Trust and Library is all taken from original sources. So I had access to the original minute books of the library as much as possible, by which I mean I think one was lost and hasn't yet been found. This is number 2, and these first volumes are not in sort of lawyer-style documents with thick covers. These are loose, almost exercise books from my childhood that they write their minutes up in. This is rather a decorative one with this gentleman in front of us. Most of them just plain. I just thought this would be rather nice to put in because it's decorative and appealed to my idea. And we move on to the next slide, please, Robert. John Rock, the Huguenot, gave us very interesting maps of the City of London and its environs in the early 18th century. And here is Cripplegate. Most of this area now is covered in the Barbican development. But if you look, you can see St. Giles Cripplegate. And then slightly to the right of that should be Sion College. And then if we take our eye up Red Cross Street, that's where the first Dr. Williams Library is based. You'll see on the right-hand side there, Dr. Williams's Library. That's it. Thank you. So Dr. Williams' library is opposite, a little bit down the road is Durin Street, which of course is where the Welsh Presbyterian Chapel is situated now. St. Giles Cripplegate is still there. And in fact, St. Giles is one of the few churches. You've got the old pre-Great Fire of London church building still surviving. Most of them, so it's not a Wren church, it predates. But it's kind of fun. But what's interesting, of course, is that the centre's library, Dr. Williams' library, and Sion College are so close. Sion College library is set up by Sion College existed for incumbents of the Church of England in the City of London proper. And there are pre-fire, maybe 100, 110 parish churches in the City of London. So for 1 square mile, you had a parish church almost every other street, sometimes every street. So everybody knew each other. All the parishioners were meant to attend. It's a very closed-in society. Sion College was where the City of London incumbents and the curates could meet and discuss things. They had a library which was like the Bodleian, like Cambridge University, would receive every copy of any book published in this country up until a certain time, but at this time it did. The dissenters did not have such a library. They didn't have colleges. Part of Dr. Williams's view is that how do young ministers, how do they get their training? Where can they go to? And so he set up the library so they had access to books. Thank you very much. We move on to our next slide, please. And this is William Bates. Arguably, Daniel Williams is not a great brain. He's an interesting man, but William Bates is a considerable intellect. You may have read some years ago of the sale of the first folio, Shakespeare first folio, by Dr. Williams. And we don't really know how the library acquired the first folio, but those of us in the know rather suspect it comes from Bates. Bates was known for his mastery of languages, although we have no record whatsoever of Bates ever leaving these shores. But he seems to have had good knowledge of Italian and Spanish. In his diary, Samuel Pepys goes along to hear William Bates' farewell sermon in 1662 in St. Dunstan's in the West, in Fleet Street. And he expects it not to be a great sermon, but comes away absolutely gobsmacked by how superb Bates' preaching was. Bates, I think, is a great brain. When Bates dies, Daniel Williams buys the whole of Bates' library for £500. It's quite a considerable sum. So we have, as it were, Dr. Williams' books that take us back to the early 16th century, which we suspect, we don't know exactly, may have come from Bates himself. So there we are. And it's painted by the portraitist Godfrey Kneller, who, of course, was German, but came over with William III. William of Orange to this country, and it's purportedly by Godfrey Kneller. Kneller is a very prolific portraitist, but Dr. Williams has something like 130, 150 portraits in its possession, the portraits are, of course, very important. I'm now perhaps talking about gifts of books throughout the 18th century. The only way in which the library could grow was either because the library had funds to go and buy new books, or because good people like you decided perhaps in their death to bequeath their whole collections to Dr. Williams. And that happened quite often. So. The founding trustee, William Harris, one of the 23 appointed by Williams before his death. Another one was Matthew Henry, but Matthew Henry managed to die before Daniel Williams, so he doesn't ever actually become an active trustee. But the founding trustee, William Harris, leaves in his will in January 1741 some 2,000 books, which is a considerable amount. Several of them will be duplicates. Some of them will be perhaps better copies than the ones in Dr. Williams, so they kept the better copy. And such a gift of 2,000 books was unusual, but it does compare favourably with Hans Sloane's gift of 1,400 books to the Bodleian between 1700 and 1738. And towards the end of the 18th century, the abolitionist Granville Sharp, who was not a dissenter at all, in his own lifetime, gives quite a few of his books and his documents. Quiet! Who, that's my wife and the Conservatives behind me. Granville Sharp gives some of his books to the library, which rather suggests that by now the library was not seen as exclusively Presbyterian, nor as even dissenting. It's been suggested, of course, that Dr. Williams' trustees may have included slave owners, but the University College London's database is based on compensation in 1833, when slavery is abolished. in the empire, and it offers evidence back to the 1760s, and no name of a document trustee appears there. And it does seem unlikely that Sharp would have given his material had the slave links been known. And of course, Unitarians and Unitarian trustees by the end of the 18th century exclusively are the trustees of Dr. Williams, Unitarians among those primarily arguing against slavery and for emancipation. And we move on then, please, Robert. Next slide. And here we have a map of Wales showing those sites which have connections to Dr. Williams' library and its trust. And you'll see the principal amount are from North Wales. Daniel Williams himself is from Wrexham on the border, which perhaps argues why he's... did he speak Welsh? It seems unlikely that he wouldn't have known some Welsh, but he's not primarily a Welsh speaker. He sets up seven schools in Wales, which are not fixed but move in terms of location. And of course, he does offer some support for the college in Carmarthen, Caerfyrddin, the Presbyterian College, as it was known until the 1950s, and the building's still there, and I've been to see it a few years back. One of the curiosities of Dr. Williams's will and the trust is that in Wales, he wanted the teaching to be in English, although most of the children would be Welsh speaking and not English speaking. In Ireland, he sets up a missionary, a minister who's effectively a missionary, who he funds. At some point that becomes two ministers, getting half the stipend each, but they are to be Irish-speaking, to convert Irish Catholics to Presbyterianism, as he understands it. And so there are awkwardnesses about Williams and about his love of the English language. Then the various schools eventually move on to, with all the educational work is then centred on the Welsh, the school for women, for girls, in Dolgellau. We better move on to that slide now, please, Robert. And there we are. And that seems to continue to about the 1960s. We've had ladies who've come into the library in my time there who were educated there, but it doesn't continue anymore, I'm afraid. Then we move on. The first library building in 1829, which is effectively 100 years after its building. The library opened in 1730 rather than 1729. They had one trustees' dinner in December 1729, so the trustees tend to have perpetuated this idea that they opened the building in 1729, but no books were transferred there till 1730. So this is the building, rather elegant building. And next slide, please, Robert. And this is inside. Those of you who have used the present building in Gordon Square will see that this resembles the reading room in Gordon Square quite considerably. I imagine Robert Southey, the poet, working in here, which he did, and finding books in Dr. Williams' library which he couldn't find anywhere else. But he said they arrived covered in dust. Well, that's been my experience most of the time as well. Now, does the library become a library for radicals? People like Mary Shelley, William Godwin are related to it. Joseph Priestley, who was never a trustee, but was a Unitarian minister as well as a scientist, of course. But they tend to be people who sympathise with the American Revolution and then later with the French Revolution, and could easily be depicted as being anti-patriotic. And then a little bit, pretty much the same time, the books and records of Theophilus Lindsay, who was, of course, Anglican vicar, and then moves to become minister of the first avowedly Unitarian church in Essex Street, off the Strand and Aldwych, that way, just backing onto the Temple. Dr. Wynne's library has an importance. You're going to shut me up at some time, aren't you? Dr. Wynne's library has an importance for funeral sermons now, for emotional history, for women's memoirs, quite across the board. But Sarah Savage, who's the daughter of Philip Henry and the sister of Matthew Henry, an English diarist, keeps a diary from the age 22 until her death in her 80s. Every day she keeps a diary. Her diaries are a bit spread out all over the place, but as much as possible, the trustees have tried to centre Dr. Williams as a place for the depositing of Sarah Savage's diaries. But there are other women who have an importance here. Libraries, we tend to think of as libraries as being places you can borrow books from, but that, of course, isn't the instance. It isn't a factor right at the beginning. Library rules permitted books to be consulted at Dr. Williams, but by the 1790s, borrowing has developed. Quite when it begins, we're not sure. Certainly, first of all, trustees, no doubt, would take books home with them. And then they begin to take them out for their family and for their friends. And women readers come in the late 18th century, led particularly by Anna Letitia Barbauld, though she isn't the only such reader. And then, of course, as far as women are concerned, what do you do about teaching in those schools, especially when the male teachers die? Should their widows, who very often are perfectly competent, should their widows carry on the school because it's part of their income? And, of course, that tends to happen. The trustees in London, a bit remote from Wales, tend to say, yes, we approve of this for the time being, but as soon as possible, appoint a man to replace the women. Often the man might be, as it were, their son or their brother, relation, perhaps. But male teachers are the unwritten rule, but women readers will grow in the 19th century, especially in the 1860s. The building in Red Cross Street in the City of London is purchased by the Metropolitan Railway, now the Metropolitan Tube Line, of course, Metropolitan Underground. So it moves to Queen Square in Bloomsbury. Queen Square is where the Children's Hospital, Great Ormond Street Hospital, is. It moves from there to Grafton Street, which is a road round the corner from Gordon Square, leading to Tottenham Court Road, and then in 1890 comes to Gordon Square. But the number of women readers grow. The move from the City of London into Bloomsbury, where the colleges are beginning to develop, allows women readers and readers in general to grow enormously. Of course, those of you who know it, Bedford College is found in Bedford Square as a women's college and only developed to allow men in a relatively recent period. There are several Unitarians on the staff of Bedford College because they're radical. They're interested in education. And there are several women who enroll as students there. And then, of course, at this time, not only the number of readers expand enormously, but curiously, you start getting the names of American and Canadian readers as well. Nathaniel Hawthorne, the American novelist, shows up for a time. Of course, University College London backs on to the present building of Dr. Williams Library, and University College London opens in 1828. King's College, just down the road, of course, University College doesn't teach theology, but it does teach Jewish studies. So among the holdings at Dr. Williams Library are a number of Jewish books, and you do occasionally see rabbis in there. Formerly, the chief rabbi was a president of the Friends of Dr. Williams. So denominational colleges, the Presbyterian College, was just down the road before it moved to Cambridge, of course, and became Westminster College. And you've got working men's colleges at Camden Town and working women's colleges also. Again, you've got to shut me up fairly soon. Among the great holdings at Dr. Williams Library, what is of great interest to people? Well, nowadays, Henry Crabb Robinson, whom several of you may never have heard of, is a diarist, a keeper of every paper note he ever made, his cleaning bills, everything, and he's a name dropper extraordinaire. He had real talent. He's a newspaper journalist in the Peninsular War. He lives from 1775 to 1867. Walter Badgett, any of you know, I think, about constitutional history, political constitution. Badgett is a young man, goes to Henry Crabbrompton's soirees. He knew Wordsworth, he knew everybody was worth knowing. And there is, at the moment, a multi-volume project which will take years to publish all his papers and his notes. That's ongoing. And it's international Germans, Americans, Englishmen. George Henry Lewis and George Eliot. George Henry Lewis is the partner of George Eliot, the novelist. And most of Lewis's library came to Docklands after George Henry Lewis's death. Lewis is a religious sceptic. His children saw Dr. Williams, therefore, as the right place to deposit his books. Interesting, that sceptical element. The same names tend to recur among the trustees: Tallamy, Kendrick, Martineau. Interestingly, Professor Dorothy Tarrant, who I think is probably related to Chris Tarrant, the TV man. Dorothy Tarrant is the first woman trustee. And she doesn't come into the 1940s. Dorothy Tarrant is the daughter of a Unitarian minister. And she's a very faithful Unitarian. But she is the first female professor of Greek in the UK, specialising in Plato. She is absolutely brilliant, an outstanding woman in many ways, and should have come in as a trustee many years before. She comes in just a few years, of course, before Geoffrey Nuttall, who you will all have heard of. And Geoffrey was a trustee at Dr. Williams for almost 50 years. He didn't quite make the 50 years. But of course, in 1975 to 77, New College closed, and Geoffrey was instrumental in arranging for the transfer of the library of the rare books and the manuscripts of New College Library, which effectively meant a history going back to dissenting academies, to Dr. Williams. Whether it was the right place for it or not is beyond my comprehension, really. But then a few years later, the Congregational Library moved to Dr. Williams. It's now detached itself. So John Creasy, who was the librarian then, had the rather difficult and demanding job of integrating the New College London collection and the Congregational Library, and arguably John did extraordinarily well. The gifts of portraits have reflected the breadth of nonconformity. And such gifts have persisted until, to the present day. Only a few years ago, a massive portrait of John Clifford, the Baptist friend of Sylvester Horne's, campaigning against the Education Bill, Education Act of 1906, turned up. And John Clifford's portrait is the size of a small wall. It's huge. But interesting that Baptist saw Dr. Williams as the right place to deposit it. Right, the first gifts of portraits that came there tended to be of trustees, although fairly quickly afterwards came, at one point I think Dr. Williams had three portraits of the Huguenot minister Daniel Chamier. So it's interesting, it's not merely Presbyterian, it's not merely Unitarian. With the New College London deposit came a rather interesting photograph of John Huxtable doing his best to look into the future, sort of visionary look of John Huxtable, I think, rather a nice one. And the artists represented by Dr. Williams are quite notable. Godfrey Kneller, as I've said, Henry Fuseli, who's a Swiss, Anglo-Swiss, William Arto, a Huguenot background, John Riley, and there are superb portraits of people like Isaac Watts, and one which I, portrait I adopted of Nicholas Byfield. All these are in the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography. Isaac Watts' portrait is superb, and we had an anonymous donor from America who'd never been over to Dr. Williams, who decided to fund the restoration of that portrait. Turns out to be a devout Catholic, but has fallen in love with Isaac Watts in his retirement. How interesting that that should happen. So what is Dr. Williams' library best known for, what should it be best known for? The Richard Baxter manuscripts. It has almost the entire collection of Richard Baxter. A little bit is now in the British Library, which went there because somebody nicked some, took some stuff home and then died, and his descendants left it to the British Library. It should come back, but it, you know, that's the way it works, isn't it? The big guy beats up the small guy. Roger Morris' entering book, which some of you may know. Morris is an ejected minister from 1662, who then lives in Covent Garden, new house probably, and then spends his life kind of being hanging around Houses of Parliament and writing a diary. His entering book is his diary, six volumes, came out a few years ago. The Owen Stockton papers and his wife, Eleanor Stockton, correspond to Joseph Priestley, etc. All those things are important, and then Ab Robinson and George Henry Lewis. And in the 20th century, when I was writing the history, it's kind of fun to see who gets funding from the trustees. The trustees are quite generous in funding Baptists, in funding Congregationalists, in funding people who don't share their principles. So amongst the names that I noticed as I was going through the funding beneficiaries are a young Charles Duffy, Stephen Mayer, Horton Davis, who gets funded and then gets a ministry in South London, and they say to him, well, you shouldn't really be getting funding from us because you're no longer a student, you're a minister. So they take his funding away and then give him a prize, so he doesn't lose out. So perhaps then I should show the book cover, Robert. So anybody, Helen was good at summing it. If you want a copy, it's £80. I'm sorry about that. But if you go to Docrooms now and ask them, you can get it for 40. So they've got copies there. If you want it a bit cheaper, it's £40. Those of you who do subscribe to the Congressional History Society magazine, I'm told that we are about to receive a delivery from the printers today. So you should be getting yours in the next couple of weeks or so. So thank you very much. That's my lot.
Great. Well, thank you very much indeed, Alan. That was, as ever, fascinating insight into Dr. Williams' library, and it gives us a nice opportunity to ask questions. So, who would like to start us off? Wave if your camera is on. It's probably better to put a chat emoji or whatever they're called. Raise your hand. Let me start with a question, Alan. I was introduced to Dr. Williams' library, I think, by my father, who in his younger days, which would be in the 40s, I guess, I think regarded it as a postal library servicing his ministry.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the things I heard you say right at the outset was that part of the vision of Daniel Williams was to support those in academies, those in ministry at the time. My perception of Dr. Williams' library by now is that it's more of a library for historical research than for sustaining current ministry. And a question, was there a shift at some time? When was that shift? What about the postal service? Is that something that ceased at a particular time?
Postal service is important, Richard. You're quite right. If you read the book, you'll find I refer to it in there. It does help with the whole expansion of the number of readers. The postal service went on until a few years ago. Of course, various structural problems with the building and the COVID crisis has meant that for the last 4 or 5 years, the building has been closed. It doesn't mean we haven't tried to help readers where we can. But the post office has closed. Your father would have benefited from that. I'm trying to respond also to your question about going there as a young man. I met, when I was leaving there some years ago, I met one of the Beyond the Fringe. I'm trying to think of his name. Chap was an opera director as well. Alan Bennett, Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, and the fourth chap, the Jewish. And he said he went there when he was 14 with his dad. First time he went to Dr. Williams' library, he knew it with his dad. You do tend to see people in there, you know, a little bit of name dropping. My first wife, Yvonne, used to say, that I sat there. She said one afternoon I sat there at the big tables, only she, Antonia Fraser, and me in the library. Antonia Fraser was writing a book on Cromwell at the time, and Yvonne claimed that I sat there the whole afternoon staring at Antonia Fraser. This I deny, entirely untrue. But she was looking at the state papers of Cromwell's spymaster, John Thurlow, which are in Dr. Williams. So that's another interesting aspect to Dr. Williams. But you do tend to see people like that in there from time to time. Or you used to when it was open.
Right. Any other questions?
A number of you are Dr.
Williams. David's got a question Over to David.
Alan, thank you for a fascinating paper. One of the things that struck me most when I read your book was how far the library in its various guises acted almost as a kind of meeting place and social centre and connecting web for the life of dissent in London. I mean, I thought particularly in the 18th century, and I just wondered if you could say a bit more about that.
Well, thank you, first of all, David, for reading the book. You will know that it's always rather fun to write a book, and then when you get it published, you kind of worry about, will anybody buy it? Will anybody read it? So thank you for reading the book. You're quite right about the social centre aspect. And of course, I think it has remained a social centre. I met Elizabeth Welch in the library there some years ago, and we became quite chatty and friendly. I met Philip March, who's here in there. I met, I don't know if I met John Thompson there. I met John Thompson certainly through Geoffrey Nuttall as well. But, you know, one tends to do that. In the 18th century, you're quite right. The library became a social centre in the same way that Sion College was for Anglicans. And it was almost a deliberate dissenting copy of Sion College in that respect. I can't quite say that in the book because that's slightly speculative on my part. But you will know that, having read the book, you will know that the coffee houses are kind of important in London in the early 18th century because Congregationalists and Baptists tended to go to certain coffee houses. Presbyterians, by which we will later mean Unitarians, at that time we don't quite mean Unitarians, but we mean Socinians, certainly are going to different coffee houses. And so they perform a function as well. What's important about Dr. Williams is that until the early 19th century, it provides a forum where these people can meet despite denominational differences. In the 19th century, perhaps as a result of legislation which enables people to be avowedly openly Unitarian and therefore allowing the Unitarian churches to set themselves up as a separate denomination, which they weren't allowed to do before legally, and the Congregational Library set up, and that because they don't want to meet with the Unitarians anymore. They see the Unitarians as being somehow beyond the Christian pale and theologically, therefore, a bit awkward. And you can see the move, and the Unitarians have kind of moved towards this radical political social agenda as well, which makes it slightly more difficult. So, and that's a breaking up, sadly, of what had been a kind of dissenting union before. And that breakup is going on throughout the 18th century. You're quite right. The first sermon that's preached in Dr. Williams' library is by Edmund Calamy, the martyrologist. And that's about 1730. And Calamy, that's maybe 1732. And Calamy therefore says how useful it is in his sermon, how great it is that they can all come together. There are differences between us, but I want us not to concentrate on the differences. I want us to concentrate on what we share together. And so he's pleading for that. And then almost immediately, you know, the fallout from Salters Hall and all sorts of other things happen. So actually the divisions are exacerbated, which is a problem for them. But yeah, there is definitely a social purpose to what they're doing, as there perhaps is to our meeting today.
Any other questions? Yes, Peter.
That's a Philip first. Okay, just a quick one, Alan. I remember you mentioning about the Welsh schools having some opposition from the authorities. Do you want to say anything about that?
Well, you will know, Peter, having read the book again, that the Welsh schools incurred considerable and lengthy, enduring opposition from Anglicans in Wales. By which I mean the Anglican incumbents in Welsh parishes tended not to make a distinction between old descent and new descent. So Methodist, which in Wales often means Presbyterian, of course, a Calvinistic Methodist. My first father-in-law was a Calvinistic Methodist, a member of Capel Charing Cross, now a nightclub, sad for Emlyn. But Methodists and Congregationists, Presbyterians, there was no distinction. Baptists, as far as the often Welsh incumbents were concerned. And so they saw any meeting there, any school being set up, as being somehow undermining their position. So often there are mobs, there are riots, there are physical intimidation, there are injunctions, there are summons to church courts, which those school teachers, often themselves ministers, but not always, had to face. And that's goes on throughout the 18th century.
And time for one very quick question from Roger.
I thought Philip had his hand up.
Hi. I've spotted Roger, but not Philip. I apologise. But only one quick one.
Well, I was just going to name drop, because I met Alan for the first time at Dr. Williams Library. And that was a very beneficial encounter. I just wanted to show my ignorance. What's the present position regarding access to Dr. Williams Library?
I've tried to avoid saying anything about Dr. Williams at the moment, Roger, and all of you will know I haven't said a word about the future. So, and you've been very kind in asking. Roger, what a nuisance you are. I think access to the library is verboten, I'm afraid. Roger. And that's, of course, a real problem for people who have got ongoing research projects, who've got PhD deadlines to fulfill. It's outside my control.
Right. Okay.
Sorry. And I think on that note, Alan, we'll draw the first part of our morning to a close. And just to reiterate the thanks that others have said as well, thank you so much for introducing us to Dr. Williams Library and its history and whetting our appetite for whatever happens in the future, and very much for our thoughts and prayers. So thank you very much, Alan, for sharing in that way.
Thank you for listening. Thank you. I'm sorry, Philip. Catch me at the end, Philip.
So we're going to take a 5-minute break there, and we'll start again at 11:05. Okay. So a bit of a comfort break just for 5 minutes. It's the second part of our morning.
Thank you, Richard. In his very learned study of Dr. Williams's library, Alan refers to visitors to the library in 1860, including Peter Lorimer of the Presbyterian College in London. And the following year, he notes that another reader was Leoni Levi. Now, Peter Lorimer's portrait hangs now in Westminster College Library. Westminster College Hall. Those references of Alan's remind us of the interconnected world of 19th century nonconformity. Lorimer was a distinguished Presbyterian historian whose book on John Knox of the Scottish Church still remains useful. He was the first principal of the English Presbyterian College, which was founded in 1844 in the wake of the disruption in Scotland of 1843. The college's London homes included a spell, as Alan says, in Queen Square before it moved to Cambridge in 1899. Westminster College after the Assembly and the Confession rather than the seat of Parliament, of course. Leone Levi was an Italian Jewish convert to Presbyterianism. He was a barrister, but he was also professor of commercial law at King's College in London from the mid-1850s. But he's best known to students of English Presbyterianism because of his superlative digest of the proceedings of the synods of the Presbyterian Church in England from 1836 to 76. Work which was continued after the Presbyterian Union of 1876 by S.W. Carruthers down into the 1920s. And I think that kind of interconnectedness is echoed in the ways in which our institutions provide archive space and research materials for scholars. So we've heard about the diversity of Dr. Williams' library from Alan, and now we're here to hear about Westminster from Helen Weller. Helen is a medievalist by training, as well as, obviously, an archivist. But prior to joining Westminster in 2010, she worked in archives, in record management, in Channel 4 television, and I'll bet that was a different task to the one that she does now, and then for Hertfordshire County Council. It's a delight to have Helen, Helen's professional expertise at our disposal. And we look forward very much to what she has to tell us about the archives and heritage collections of the College, the Chesham Foundations, and the United Reformed Church History Society, all of which fall under her care at Westminster. So, Helen, we look forward very much to hearing from you.
Thank you. Okay, now I'm going to try and share my screen. So, ta-da! Okay. So thank you very much, David, and hello, everyone. And as David says, I'm the archivist at Westminster College, Cambridge. And I might as well admit to you now, after Alan's fascinating talk, that I have not written a book about the history of the library at Westminster. But I'm going to talk to you about the history of the college library and hopefully illustrate that history by showing you some of our riches and our treasures from the collections, from the archives, the libraries and the historical collections. So we're going to start with this picture, which is Westminster College in Cambridge. We are a resource centre for learning for the United Reformed Church, but our history begins in London in 1844. As David said, this is a key moment in the history of the Presbyterian tradition in England. There's the disruption of the Church of Scotland in 1843, and then the Presbyterian synods in England decide they're going to become the Presbyterian Church in England. It's a new church, and a new church, it needs new ministers. And that's where we come in. So our college begins as the English Presbyterian College in London. So this, come on, don't let me down, technology. Ta-da! This is a set of minutes from a meeting on Boxing Day in 1843, which say our college would be a good thing. These minutes are in the college archives. And at the top of this page, you should be able to just see that it says, that in the present state of the Presbyterian cause in England, it is most desirable that immediate steps be taken to establish a Presbyterian theological seminary. And immediate steps are indeed taken. And less than 1 year later, the college is ready to open to its first students in autumn 1844. And right from the very beginning, the need for an educated ministry is seen as vital. So the synod minutes say the college should provide, I quote, the benefits of a literary, philosophical and theological education to qualify its students for the office of holy ministry in the Presbyterian Church. And for an educated ministry, you need books. You need books for the ministers to study and for them to teach from. And knowledge itself is a treasure. And that is why the library has been a key part of the college right from the very beginning. And Peter Lorimer, who David just mentioned, was one of the two professors at the college and its first principal. And he wrote a circular for the church 2 months before the college opened. And in this circular, he asked all ministers of the church to make known from the pulpit that the college would need support and it would need candidates for ministry. And very specifically, it would need books for the library. So this first appeal by Lorimer generates 650 books for the library in 6 months. That's the key nucleus of the college library when it opens in 1844. And in May 1845, Lorimer is writing to the church again. This time he writes in the Church Magazine, which is the Presbyterian Messenger. And this is his appeal. And he says explicitly that members of the church can help the new college by making an energetic effort not only to improve the funds of the college, but to enrich its library. We look for many more donations of books, he says. And then he prints this, which I think is gorgeous, because it's basically an 1840s edition of an Amazon wish list. He's basically putting all the things he would like. And then he says, please pay particular attention to the editions that I've asked for, because I really want my students to be able to learn from the best and have the definitive text. So it's a fantastic thing. And this really chimed for me with what Alan was just saying about Dr. Williams's library at around the same time and a bit earlier for Alan. It's basically, this is the approach that they take, that Westminster takes for the next 100 years. The library is a really grateful recipient of donations of money and donations of books. Though I also must say, in case you think it's only concerned with money and donations, the November 1846 issue of the Presbyterian Messenger reminds the whole church readership that contributions to the college are essential, but prayers are essential also. And I just think that's lovely. That's a theological college. And it's perhaps worth remembering that in the 1840s, when Lorimer is putting out these appeals, books are not exactly a luxury item, but they're a valuable commodity. And as an example, and this example, I'm afraid, is going to have to stand for many, I'm going to tell you a story about Reverend James Hamilton, who is my next treasure. This is Reverend James Hamilton. So Hamilton is a Presbyterian minister, and he gave a series of lectures at the college in the 1840s, and he was to be paid £60 for those lectures, but he refused to take the money and said, please return the money to the college funds. And when he did this, the college committee decided the best way of recording their gratitude for this munificent donation was to lay out the sum in the purchase of books for the library, the works to be selected by Mr. Hamilton himself, which is lovely. But it's also quite staggeringly generous. £60 is one-fifth of Lorimer, the professor's, entire salary for the year. Lorimer, who wrote that appeal, preached from the pulpit, earned £300 a year. Hamilton has just waived nearly 3 months' salary to be donated to the College for Books. And I think another thing that occurs to me when I was finding out about Hamilton and his gift is that when you think about the 1840s, when the college is founded, estimated literacy rates are at about 65% for men and 50% for women. By 1900, they're up at about 97% for both, because there's a century of educational reform in the middle. But Hamilton and Lorimer are receiving books not just in English, but also in Latin and Greek and French and German. And they're also teaching their students Hebrew and Syriac and Aramaic. So the knowledge in the library is a treasure, and it's not something that everyone in the 1840s can unlock. Anyway, this portrait of Hamilton, which is in the college art collections, is by John James Napier. And after I've just, for the story I've just told you about Hamilton, there's two things I think are particularly nice about this picture. Firstly, you can see he's got books not just on his table behind him, but also on the floor leaning up against his chair. He's got these two really big volumes, and you can even see he's put the little page markers in them, the little white squares of paper sticking out so that he can turn to the right page when he needs to. And the second lovely thing is this portrait is still in the college library 180 years later. So donations of money and books keep arriving through the 1850s. And after 10 years, the college library has increased from 650 books to about 1500 books. And in the 1860s, the college moves here to Queen Square House on Queen Square. Also, as Alan says, so we should be just around the corner. Our college is here from 1864 to 1899. So I think we're still here by the time Dr. Williams, just before, yes, good, Alan is nodding. this is an aquatint from 1812, so it's a little bit early. As you can see, when you look at what the people are wearing, that's much more 1812 than 1860. But the college is this building near the front with the little sticky out colonnade-y thing and the two big columns. And the church rents this college building on a 30-year lease. It's got 15 student bedrooms, it's got lecture rooms, and it's got a library, dedicated library space. And that's just as well, because throughout the 1860s, as well as the occasional donations, we start seeing the first gifts of entire library collections. So a person's entire library, and also, as Alan says, often when they die. So Daniel Robertson's library is more than 1,000 books, and that was given to the college in 1866. That's the first entire library that I've seen. And there are lots of further personal libraries which follow. And as the college library adjusts to processing these large collections, the committee adopts a policy of not duplicating books. And that's something we still try and hold to today. And in the 1870s, we see the college committee specifically requesting library funding for the first time, not just as donations from generous members of the church, but as part of the designated annual spend. So they say some moderate sum ought to be annually devoted to the preservation and increase of the college library. And they simultaneously have this really practical suggestion, and it comes from the committee, but also from donors, saying trifling and useless books and unnecessary duplicates should be sold, which obviously has a double reward. Firstly, it frees up space, makes more room as the library becomes fuller. And secondly, the money made from selling those books means that you can spend that money on necessary books of theology. So basically, yes, we want an educated ministry, but there needs to be some selection, because do we really need a book on the mathematics of conic sections, or one of my personal favourites, Bulgarian folk songs and proverbs, both of which I've seen listed in the new deposits lists. So, and at the same time in the 1870s, we also see the first catalogue of the library. And I've put in a picture of me holding it to give you a sense of scale. It's a handwritten book, and it's quite fittingly, I think it is the largest and probably the heaviest book in the entire Library and Archives collections. It's about 2 feet tall and 1 foot wide when it's closed, and it weighs about as much as a 5-year-old. It's enormous. So when we start listing the books, the college library starts keeping a closer track of what's coming in, and this idea of not duplicating becomes more relevant. And then in the 1880s, we have the first explicit example of the need to preserve denominational publications for the library. The library receives copies of all the synod records from 1836 onwards. That's the synod, the annual synod meeting of the church, Presbyterian Church in England at the time. And then it receives copies of the Presbyterian Messenger, which is the monthly magazine of the church. And there's actually even, as another example of wider awareness, the church says it plans to send copies to the British Museum Library as well. So there's a sense of kind of heritage developing here. And in the 1890s, the library starts to acquire collections of artifacts and objects. There's a collection of communion tokens exhibited at the College Jubilee in 1894, where they're actually called Presbyterian relics, and I was really quite surprised to see that as a description. And they were purchased for the college library in 1897. That's the first specific example I found of non-book treasures being listed in the library reports. Now, I'd just like to go back to the Presbyterian Messenger quickly. This is the church magazine that's given to the library in 1880. It began in the 1840s and it still exists today. It still runs. It's published. It used to be published then, certainly monthly. But what I like about it is it gives you such an amazing wealth of everyday detail. So this is basically a sample page from the February 1880 edition, the year the series was given to the library. And each issue has news and opinion pieces about the church, about home missions, foreign missions, ministers, missionaries, individual churches, the church as a whole. Now, I'm quite a big fan of history from below and the idea of the history of the common man. So what I like is from this episode, this issue, I can tell you things like the Reverend J.K. Craig of Ancoats in Manchester declined a call from the congregation in Southampton. And I can tell you that the Sunday school in Ramsey on the Isle of Man celebrated its jubilee with a tea party and singing of hymns by the children. And I can tell you a sale of work at the church in Bradford raised £155. I love this kind of ephemeral detail. I find it absolutely fascinating. But as well as all the detail from the home church, the Presbyterian Messenger also tries to include foreign mission news. It's very heavily weighted in that direction, certainly at some points during its publication history. So what you can see here is an illustration of the approach to the harbour in Takao in Taiwan. And it's preceded by a call for missionaries to serve in Singapore, and it's followed by an account of a women's prayer meeting in China. But it's also It acts as a reminder, after all that home church news, that just how far away the church's missionaries are. The Presbyterian Church had a strong mission field in China, and there aren't any photographs, just engravings. The news comes by letter, so most news is several months out of date. And letters from missionaries, like these ones that you can see here, and accounts from missionaries, are published in the National Church magazine, because not just because they're interesting, but because they are rare. They are from the other side of the world. And just like in the library, it's information, which is a treasure. So, I've got one further important development to mention in the 1880s. I said in the early history that we have gifts of books and we have gifts of money. And in the 1880s, we had a third donation, which is the gift of time. And that time is given by the librarians. So in 1881, the first honorary librarian is formally appointed. It's Mr. J.G. Smeaton, who has kindly consented to undertake the duty as a labour of love to the church. Smeaton remains librarian throughout the 1880s and 1890s till his retirement in 1905. And what you're looking at now is a book that was given to him when he retired. So we've got correspondence from Smeaton and from Islay Burns, who is his successor as librarian. We've got correspondence from the both in the library, and we've got library committee minutes. But I think this is just unbelievably gorgeous and worth looking at more than minutes, because it's so pretty. It's basically a decorative album presented to Smeaton when he retires as librarian, like I say, in 1905. And it's full of photographs of all the students at the college. Each page is a kind of has like a double page construction, so you can push the photographs up in between so that each one is mounted. And most of the students have signed their photographs. Somebody else has later added the places of their ministry. And the album itself is made by Edward T. Brewer, photographer of Newcastle upon Tyne. And he's decorated the pages with flowers. Every single page has gold illustration. You can just see the edges of the binding around this where the book's open in this photograph. But it's got all this amazing gold tooling on the front, and you can see this fancy gold clasp. It's just a really beautiful thing, and I think it underlines how important the librarians are to the students, how they facilitate access to information for all those students learning at the college. And what's particularly nice about this album is that it was returned, given back to the college for the archives, by Smeaton's daughter about 80 years after it was given to him. So he clearly thought it was a treasure, and so did his family. So throughout the 1880s and 1890s, various collections continue to be received from ministers and benefactors. And by 1886, there are 7,500 books in the library. 5 years later, there's 9,500 books, and the library accommodation is basically becoming inadequate. There's just not enough space. The committee proposes a building extension. But in the same year, the committee is informed that Mrs. Lewis and Mrs. Gibson, two sisters who live in Cambridge, have offered to purchase a piece of ground in Cambridge and present it to the church as a site for college buildings. And those new buildings in Cambridge will be able to contain the expanding library collections. So after 55 years in London and 326 students, the church says, yes, please, and thank you very much. And so the next thing I'm going to show you is an archives treasure from the time this new college in Cambridge is being built. This is a notebook belonging to James Goodman on the Westminster College Buildings Committee. And his notebook contains pretty much 5 years' worth of notes of meetings with Henry Hare, the architect, and William Saint, the builder. And Goodman is kind of checking everything, taking it back to the committee, reporting on progress. He reports on everything from the fact that we need an umbrella and hat stand for the hallway, and the chimney pots cost £5.5, and the detail is amazing. So this page that you can see here shows Goodman's to-do list for July the 12th, 1899, 3 months before the college in Cambridge opens its doors. And you can see about halfway down, he's got a note saying the main library, one half of the dado is to be delivered this week. And then just under that, the ends are all panelled, half standard, and the shelves are ready for putting together. So he's writing this in July, and in October, the college opens its doors. at which point, the library has 10,500 volumes, and the library is described as one of the most striking features of this new college. It's the largest room in the building. It's oak panelled. It has a double height ceiling, and it's designed by an architect who built at least 8 libraries and is described as the most prolific public library architect of the period. So here's 2 pictures of the library, and I particularly like this one, the photograph by William Butcher, because it shows the building so new, the books haven't all been unpacked onto the bookshelves yet. And something else I think is interesting about the design of the library is that Henry Hare, who's the architect, designs the library so one end of it is actually the chapel. It's just separated off by a row of bookshelves and a pair of sort of openwork gates. And I think this might be like a symbolic positioning within the college of 2 central tenets of studying for ministry in the Presbyterian Church of England. It's learning and it's worship, and the one leads to the other in both directions. So when the college library opens in 1899, there are some new developments in access and acquisitions and collections diversity. So for the first time, students are allowed to access open shelves under carefully prepared rules, instead of having all the books in locked, glass-fronted bookcases. For the first time, the college library received gifts of manuscripts and photographs from those same 2 sisters who gave the plot of land. For the first time, portraits are presented with the stated intent that they be hung in the library. The first 2 are Sir George Bruce, who's a college benefactor, and Thomas Guthrie, who's a benefactor of Ragged Schools. Guthrie is still in the library. Bruce is now on the stairs on the way up to the library. And for the first time, the library houses archaeological material. There's a special cabinet built to house all the Romano British and Saxon pottery that's discovered when the land is excavated for the building of the college. But there's another hidden legacy here from Smeaton. Remember Smeaton, the librarian? So in the archives, we have Smeaton's correspondence with his friend Alan Wyon, who's an engraver and actually the engraver of royal seals. And Smeaton asks Wyon, would you please design a book plate for the new Westminster College? So this is what Wyon designed, and it's got this lovely set of symbols. You can see Cairo and the Alpha and the Omega. There's the burning bush at the top, which is the emblem of the Presbyterian Church of England, and the open book in the centre, the Word of God, that's the emblem of the college. And a huge percentage of the books in the library still have this book plate in them that Smeaton commissioned, which I think is a lovely memorial to someone who gave 24 years as a volunteer librarian. So the college library continues to grow and flourish in Cambridge. In 1905, we have the first of a set of donations from Monsieur le Pasteur Bourgeois, which is the Huguenot collection. There's nearly 400 books given by him in several tranches. Also in 1905, we have the inauguration of the Peyton Library, which is 1,500 books forming a lending library scheme available to ministers of any nonconformist denomination. And then as we go on through the 1910s, and particularly the 1920s, we see further manuscript gifts, especially from Mrs. Lewis and Mrs. Gibson. And they give the college manuscripts in Arabic and Syriac and Coptic and Hebrew. So I'll show you one of those, because this really is quite a library treasure. This is the beginning of a homily by a 4th century bishop called Amphilochius of Iconium, and he's writing about John chapter 14, verse 28. And this is a lovely example of a Syriac manuscript. It's an 8th century copy in Syriac Estrangula script. However, I will say, if you're not a fluent reader of 8th century Syriac, nor am I, and you might like to know that those sort of beautiful twirly decorations in yellow and green, the bit underneath them in red is the start of the text from John and the start of the homily. So this manuscript is what we would catalogue as dispersed, which means we've got part of it and the rest of it is held elsewhere. And in this instance, elsewhere is the British Library in London. Our folio is from the middle of the work and it's undated. But, we can date it because of the British Library bit. So the British Library bit includes a colophon, which is the information a scribe writes at the end of a manuscript saying who wrote it and when. So we know from their colophon that our manuscript was copied out by a scribe called Gabriel in Edessa in the year 723. And that is just the most amazing. I find that amazing that we even have the guy's name who wrote this. So it's an 8th century copy of a 4th century homily, given in the 1920s by those 2 sisters. So when we go back to the 20th century and those 2 sisters and further library gifts, we're back at the same problem of space. So as early as 1913, that's only 14 years after the new college has opened, as early as 1913, there's mentions in the college committee report there isn't enough space in the library. And each year they declare this slightly more desperately until 1922, when there are an estimated 20,000 volumes in the library and associated collections. But luckily, in 1921, the new college chapel opens, and the new chapel is an extension to the building, which means the bit of the library space that used to be chapel can now become library and gets filled up with books. In the 1930s, I found an interesting note on what we would now call disaster recovery strategy. There's a duplicate catalogue created for purposes of fire insurance. And this is the first time I saw a specific mention of fire since the very, very first set of the college accounts in the 1840s, which had a budget line for fire insurance on the library to Lady Day 1848. And that original insurance was £1, 1 shilling and no pence. That was the only fire insurance on the whole college. They only insured the library. This 1930s report about disaster recovery, well, about an extra catalogue, is followed by a mention in 1941 that in view of the risks due to enemy action, manuscript and other treasures of the library have been placed in the college strong room, though the college was actually never damaged by enemy action in the war. It's interesting that that's a consideration. Moving on through the 1940s, we come to another amazing collection which was given. This is from the Elias Collection of Hymnology, which is about 3,000 books bequeathed to the college in 1942 in the will of Edward Alfred Elias. And this is a volume of church praise, which was the hymn book of the Presbyterian Church of England. And you can see it's inscribed on the flyleaf, Martha Elias, and it says, to Edward Alfred Elias on his 15th birthday from his mother, October 27th, 1890. So one of the things I really like about this is you could probably safely say, not every 15-year-old wants a hymn book for their birth. And I say that as the proud owner of a 15-year-old. But Edward is born in 1875, which is actually a really interesting time of huge change in hymns and music within the Presbyterian tradition of worship. And that's reflected in his collection of hymn books. So the roots, forgive me if you all know all this, but I imagine that I found this quite an interesting thought, is that the roots of the 19th century Presbyterian churches, especially the Scottish churches, lie in a tradition where the congregation don't sing hymns. They sing metrical psalms or scriptures, they're led by a precentor, they don't have musical accompaniment. But when the Presbyterian Church in England is formed in the 1840s, and it becomes independent of the Church of Scotland, the new English church considers its position on hymns, and by 1857, enough people are in favour of congregational hymn singing that the church publishes a hymn book, and then it publishes another one that's even larger 10 years later in 1867. And then when the ban on organs in church is lifted in the 1870s, a third hymn book, Church Praise, is published in 1885. So this book, given to Edward by his mum on his 15th birthday, is a copy of that hymn book, the 1885 Church Praise. Edward Elias wasn't the minister of the church, and he wasn't an elder, and we don't know what drew him to collect and study hymn books for the rest of his life, but I'd like to think maybe this birthday present could have been what inspired him. And anyway, the arrival of his collection, all 3,000 books of it, put space in the library at a premium again. So as we move from the 1940s to the 1950s, in 1953, the Reverend Carey's family make a donation to the college in memory of their son, the minister, Reverend Carey, to pay for a new secure strong room to be created, specifically in which rare and precious books and archives can be stored. And in 1964, we see there's new shelving being added to the tower specifically for the Elias collection and for some older journals, and it says other books infrequently used. So, holding all that in your heads, we then have a union with another college in 1967, which also results in another huge library collection joining the Westminster collection on site. So in 1967, Westminster College unites with Cheshunt College, which was founded by the Countess of Huntingdon in 1768 to train young men for ministry in the independent tradition, and their library and archives collections date back to the 1760s too. So this is one of six manuscript letters between Lady Selina Hastings, the Countess of Huntingdon, and John and Charles Wesley. And these are all contained in the Cheshunt archives. So here you can see John Wesley writing to the Countess in January 1764. And I don't know if you can see it on your screens, but this letter starts, "Shall I tell your ladyship just what is in my mind? Without any disguise or reserve, I believe it will be best to do so. And I think your ladyship can bear it." They're fascinating. And he then goes on to discuss other preachers. And he also describes his own preaching style as too rough for tender ears. So this is definitely one of the Chesnut treasures for me. 25 years on from this, after the Countess dies in 1791, her college trustees move the college from Trevecca, which is in Brecon in Wales. They move it from Trevecca to Chesnut in Hertfordshire, which is why it's called Chesnut College. In 1905, the college moves again from Chesnut to Cambridge. Most of Chesnut's students, in the 19th and 20th centuries went on to ministry in the congregational tradition. So when Westminster and Chesnut colleges unite in 1967, their union is prefiguring the union of many of the Presbyterian and congregational churches in 1972 and the formation of the United Reformed Church. And when the two colleges join together, the Chesnut buildings are sold, Chesnut students and staff and library move into Westminster and bring all their amazing library and archives collections. So I'm going to show you another treasure from Chesnut, which is the oldest written records I think we have in the entire library. And you can see I'm saying written records and not documents, because they're not documents. They're not on paper or vellum or papyrus. They're on clay. So this is one of six clay cuneiform tablets. They are Neo-Babylonian and they're written in the reign of Nabopolassar, who is, as I'm sure you're all aware, the leader of the Babylonian uprising against the Assyrians. he's the father of Nebuchadnezzar. But because of this, we know that they date from about the 7th century BCE. And they've been translated, this one's been translated by John Guinness as being from the ancient city of Sippar, which is now Tel Abu Hubba in Iraq. And it's a list of offerings, including numbers of oxen and sheep offered to the gods of Sippar. Yeah, the oldest thing we have. So Chesnut archives and library collections come to Westminster at the end of the 60s. Chesnut contributes to the library fund. Chesnut pays for clerical time to make another much more up-to-date catalogue of the library collection. And it's going to be Library of Congress standard. And it's going to have a title and subject index as well as an author index. And generally, hurrah. And then as we go on through the last few decades of the 20th century, as well as there's the familiar pattern of purchases and gifts for the library and donations, in the 1970s, we also see Westminster becoming part of the Cambridge Theological Federation, which is a collaborative ecumenical partnership of theological institutions within Cambridge. And it results in a wider sharing of library resources, including cataloguing and staff. 1980s sees the appointment of Marion Foster as the first professional librarian at the college. And then in the 1990s, to sit alongside the Westminster collections and the Chesnut collections, we have the United Reformed Church History Society collections, which moved to the college in 1999. This is the Library and Archives of the History Society, which began as the Presbyterian Historical Society, which was founded in 1913 for the specific purpose of preserving, classifying, and cataloguing for use books, documents and other objects of historical interest. So this collection has a real denominational focus. And as treasures go, perhaps the most treasury thing in the History Society collections is this, which is the only manuscript copy known of the Westminster Confession of Faith. Now, this is a really important document in the history of the Presbyterian Church because it's one of the statements of faith on which the church is built. In 1643, cast your minds back, in 1643, Parliament invited 121 learned, godly and judicious divines and 30 laymen to provide advice on issues of worship, doctrine and government in the Church of England. They're trying to work out a structure for the new church. They meet every day in the Jerusalem Chamber at Westminster Abbey from 1639 to 1649. From 1643 to 1649. They are the Westminster Assembly. This is the Westminster Confession of Faith. And as David said, that's why we are Westminster College. So on the 26th November 1646, the minutes of that assembly record the confession was finished this day. And this document that you can see is the fair copy. It's prepared by Cornelius Burgess and submitted to the members of the Commons and Lords on December 3rd. And I've chosen this page, page 241, because I thought it had two interesting things about Cornelius Burgess and the scribe, which is, firstly, you can see he's missed a word from the chapter title and he's had to add it in later. It's of God and then of the Holy Trinity. And when you notice that, you notice how many other mistakes there aren't. And I was trying to remember the last time I wrote a whole page. I'm not a scribe, but I'd like to try and think, when was the last time I wrote a whole page and only made one mistake? And the second thing I think is nice about this is if you look at the very bottom of the page, you can see how the very last word is a sneaky preview of the next page. So it says his just on a line of its own at the bottom. And he's added that to help words flow for the reader. So you know what's coming up next as you read. And you quite often see it in published editions, but you don't usually see it in manuscripts. I know the point of this manuscript is it's going to go and be published, but I kind of find it's interesting to see it in a manuscript text. The Parliament gives its approval to this document in June 1648, but then episcopacy is once again favoured in the Church of England after the restoration of the monarchy in 1660, so it isn't adopted by the Church of England. The Church of Scotland, which is Presbyterian, does adopt the confession, and in 1943 the manuscript was presented to the Presbyterian Historical Society. But to set along that, alongside that, I'd like to show you a different treasure from the library collections of the URC History Society with a different tone. This is based on another one of the Westminster Assembly's documents, the Shorter Catechism. And as with any catechism, it's a sort of statement of faith and a set of questions and answers. And I have it on good authority that if you ask someone who grew up in the Presbyterian Church of England, what is the chief end of man, they will promptly reply, man's chief end is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. And that's the first of the 38 questions in this catechism. But this book is from 1922, and it's written by Reverend John Fox, who's a father who wanted his children to learn the catechism. And he thought it might be easier if he set it to music. So not only does this book cover all 38 questions and their answers, but it's also dedicated on the front page to my two catechumens who began to learn the Shorter Catechism by singing this music at the age of 6 and 7 years. And I really like this because to me that's a story with a very personal core of trying to help your children grow up in a faith and trying to convert something in a long grown-up format into a format children can cope with more easily. Maybe again, it's knowledge is a treasure. So the arrival of the History Society collections takes the history of the library up to 2000. And in the past 20 years since then, we've basically gone through academic librarians and federation librarians and my predecessor, the lovely Margaret Thompson, and me as the archivist. And we've all carried on with the work of the libraries and the rare books collections and the archives held at the college. There have been more new accruals, there have been cataloguing, there have been online systems, there's been library moves and new accommodation and hopefully some more stuff that I plan to get online soon. But I want to finish off with this one final treasure. So this is a fragment from the Book of James from the 6th or 7th century. Obviously, it's very ancient. It's part of the Bible and it's in Greek. And I like that because it harks back to those scholars who began in the college library in the 1840s studying the Bible in Greek and Latin and Aramaic. But it's also one of our library treasures that we've digitised. And I think that is going to be one of the key elements looking at library history for the next few decades is online. And in addition, this is part of a collaborative project, which I think is another key strategy in libraries in the 21st century. So this manuscript is digitised as part of the Polonsky Greek project, which is organised by Cambridge University Library in partnership with Heidelberg and the Vatican Libraries, sponsored by the Polonsky Foundation, and basically the project aimed to digitise manuscripts in Greek held at all the Cambridge colleges, and Westminster was invited to participate. All the images are held on the Cambridge Digital Library website, which is run by the UL, but it hosts treasures from a multitude of Cambridge colleges and departments and institutions. It's very ecumenical, and it's all online, so it's accessible for free to the international community of scholars, and I think that's today's way of sharing treasures and sharing knowledge and having an educated ministry. So I'm sorry if I've gone over time, but I can probably say 30 minutes isn't enough, and I feel there's so much I should have said about the history of the church and the history of the college and all the different collections. And there are many more treasures that I could share, and I'm sorry I couldn't include everything, but I hope that's at least given you a bit of an outline and an overview of Westminster College and its riches.
Helen, thank you so much for that fascinating overview of Westminster College Library. Those were collections I thought I knew pretty well, but I've learned an awful lot this morning, and we're all in your debt for your extraordinary expertise. It was a particular delight to know, for me to know, that Alan Wyon created the college book plate, not least because he was the father of Olive Wyon, who was one of the great Presbyterian writers on spirituality, and, you know, one of the women who really needs to be rediscovered properly in the history of English Christianity, and ended up as a great friend and supporter of Cecily Saunders and the hospice movement. So many fascinating links there. Open for questions.
If I might, David, I'd just like to say Helen is wonderful, and you'll notice that I thanked her with others at the front of my book on Dr. Williams Library. She's always responsive and a wonderful person to be in that position. I'm very grateful to her. I'm also thankful to Sally Thomas, who told me the person I couldn't remember his name of is Jonathan Miller, I was talking about earlier, who I met at Dr. Williams. I think, Helen, you'd agree with me that we might be a bit more choosy about chucking away or selling duplicate books now, because now we discover that when we look at our duplicate books, they were owned by someone, as you've often in your illustrations shown us, and that someone may have added a few notes in the margin on various pages, and suddenly that book becomes less a printed book and more of a manuscript, and therefore much more valuable. And that's the way history is going at the moment.
Yes, that's a really interesting point. And when you look at people who want to study marginalia and ownership of books, there are more questions that I'm getting about that. I also found a book in the Rare Books collections. I wrote a blog post about it last month, and it's got a really interesting inscription by two totally normal, utterly unheard of women, where one of them says, "This book was given to me on this day by my sister. She left for London." And I don't know anything else about these two women, but it's dated, I think, 1760. So it's women's literacy. It's women's movement. You can see that both these women have different surnames. So one or both of them is probably married. No one else is. There's no mention of any men. It's just me and my sister. It's the most fantastic, tiny little window into two people's lives. The kind of people that aren't recorded in the official history of stuff. They're just normal people. I find that kind of inscription absolutely fascinating.
Time for more. Forgive me if I'm missing anybody. I'm scrolling through my seat. Alan, your hand is up.
Hello. As a former Presbyterian and as a musician, I'm fascinated, and I must be very sad, fascinated by a musical setting of the Shorter Catechism, which I remember having to learn before being admitted to the Lord's table as a teenager. And I'm fascinated that who was he called? John Fox?
Yes.
Set it to music. That doesn't happen to be digitized, does it? Or is that...
You know, I was looking it up on Google yesterday to see if I couldn't find it, sadly, but I really hoped somebody on YouTube would have done a performance of it. It's somebody on YouTube, but it's not performing his, it's some sort of solo guitar-y songwriter chap. But as far as I know, I didn't find it, but I tell you what, I will have a look for it afterwards, and if I find it, I'll let you know.
Lovely.
It's quite hard to Google because John Fox obviously comes up with a very different set of results.
Catherine, you have your hand up.
Thank you. It was just really to make a comment, just to say I've really enjoyed both of the talks this morning. It's the first time I've been able to join this kind of online meeting, so thank you very much for both of it. And I'd just like to agree with Helen on the idea of giving my 15-year-old, who will be 15 in July, a hymn book for his birthday and what his reaction would be. So that did make me chuckle. So I'd like to commend the idea of hymn books for 15-year-olds to the gathered people and see what kind of reaction we get. I think that'd be quite amusing.
Yeah, lifelong collection is obviously the only answer.
Any other comments or questions? Okay. Sorry, my screen has stuck. So if you're wanting to ask a question, please do.
Can I just come in? I've got my hand up. It's Roger. I just wanted to go back to John Fox just before I ask a question. Thanks for the two talks. They've been brilliant. And as someone who's more of an outsider, I have really, really learnt a great deal. So thank you to the two main speakers. I was very struck with John Fox's book that, in fact, it was published in America. And I assume, therefore, that he is American. And I just wondered what his denominational affiliation would have been as a result of that.
Got to say, I don't know off the top of my head. He could well have been, I don't know if he was even a minister or just a Presbyterian, but there certainly are Presbyterian denominations in the state.
He could have been
a member of the PCUSA. But I'm sorry, I don't have enough background information about him to be able to answer that straight away. But I can look into it, if you like.
He was a reverend, so I'm assuming he's a minister in any way. Okay, but as you say, John Fox is not a name to Google with. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Time maybe for one more, if anyone's got anything else they wish to contribute.
Okay, I can see Jackie has her hand up.
Oh, right. Thank you.
Yeah, it was partly a question for people who might know rather more about the ecumenical movements. It seemed to me that perhaps the history of both colleges reflects how, first of all, things got more divided and then things got much more collaborative. And we end up with the Vatican funding Greek manuscript publication online, which I think is wonderful. I'm all for ecumenism. That seems to be a really good idea. But other people who know rather more might be able to comment rather better.
I think technically the Vatican didn't fund the publication. They were one of the people whose libraries... it was a project funded by the Polonsky Foundation to digitise Greek manuscripts in the library in Heidelberg and in the Vatican and here. But yes, you're right. I love that idea of wide ecumenical sharing. But also, I don't feel like I'm the expert to answer that question.
I think one of the great impetuses behind collaboration has been biblical studies. Since it's, really took off end of the 19th century. And from then on, we've seen increasing cooperation. And as Catholic biblical scholarship developed, particularly in the 40s, 50s, 60s, we've seen a huge ecumenical, international academic gathering around that kind of information and a generosity in sharing it. Any other thoughts before we draw our morning to a conclusion? Yeah, I think Richard, it's over to you now.
Yes, just really to draw our time towards a close. to thank both Helen and Alan once again. I think one of the things that struck me in both talks was the way in which a library gives a glimpse of ordinary people, and those ordinary people have immense stories to tell. And I think it's one of those things that makes history not just an exercise in nostalgia, as someone told David at some point, but it's something that actually connects with just people today. And it's making those connections is the excitement of history. And a big thank you both to Helen and Alan for prompting our thinking in that way today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. Let's close with a moment of prayer. Gracious God, we thank you for the generosity of those who have gone before us in faith. We thank you for their appreciation of the importance of knowledge in all its aspects, of a learned church and an educated laity and a trained ministry. We thank you for the two institutions, Dr. Williams's Library and Westminster College, with Chesnut College and the Cambridge Theological Federation, and for all that they have done through their histories to equip the saints for ministry. So we ask that you will bless us and take our time and skills and use them as though, as you have used those of the past, to build up the kingdom of your Son, wherever we may be and wherever you may call us. We ask it in Jesus' name and for his sake. Amen. It remains for me to say, as Richard has done, thank you to everybody. Special thank you to Richard and to Michael in his absence for all the technical planning of this joint meeting, and to Robert at Westminster for facilitating the IT today. And I think this has been a most interesting exercise in bringing our societies together, and I hope you'll allow the sort of two bodies to reflect on the experience and see what we might do in the future. But thank you so much to everybody for your attendance and your participation today.